Greenbelt, welcome, please.
That's great. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you for potentially giving up your lunch time. Who is waiting for lunch? Right. Okay. So if the blood sugar levels get low, that's when the questions get bad. So I'm braced. I wanted to know where the bad questions were going to come from. Okay. So what I'm going to talk about is, the title is The Naked Banker. I have to say, that wasn't my idea. That was my boss's idea. And I thought, okay, well, I'll go with it. But basically, it's about transparency in banking, and not wanting to hide stuff that we do. So I'm going to talk about why transparency is so important. And what I'm going to outline is why money and debt is all about social interaction, and why transparency in those social interactions is important, how that's become lost, and why it would be really good to get it back again. Mainly because your money is power, and perhaps we need to be thinking about who is using the power of your money and what are they doing with it. So I apologize if it seems a bit like an advertisement for Triodos, but really what I want to get across is how banking could be more socially useful again, and Triodos is really the only example that I've got readily to hand, but there are others, as you'll see. So I wanted to start with where did money come from? So a little sort of canter through the history of money, okay? Lots of people think money has given rise to debt. Actually, it's the other way around. Debt started way before money. So just imagine that thousands of years ago, there's a family of cave dwellers, and somebody goes out. I'm not going to be sexist and sort of just make an assumption about who might have gone out and done the hunting. Somebody goes out and does some hunting. They come back with a wild boar, and the people who were left back at the camp say, "Thank you very much. That's a lovely wild boar. I owe you one wild boar casserole à la chasse and a beautiful pigskin loincloth. But it's going to take a little while for me to make the casserole, and it's going to take even longer for me to make the loincloth. So in the meantime, I owe you." So that's a debt. Move on a few thousand years, and you've got a pig farmer. And somewhere in the same village, there are a couple of tanneries, and there are a couple of, smokeries, let's say. Okay, and so the pig farmer has raised his pig. The tannery and the smokery owners want to have some meat, so they've got some meat, but also the pig farmer wants to get his meat preserved, and he wants it to get turned into pigskin. So while he's waiting, there's a debt there. So there's a social transaction that's taking place. What's more, the pig farmer can actually make a choice about where he goes, where he makes that social transaction. So he can decide, for instance, to use the tannery that is upstream from the village, or he can use the one that's downstream from the village. And if I were him, I think I'd probably use the one downstream from the village, because otherwise it's going to pollute the washing place in the middle of the village. Likewise, I might use the smokery that is downwind, or generally downwind from the village rather than upwind, because otherwise all the smoke's going to blow over the village. So he has a choice about where he goes. He can also choose on the basis of trust, whether he likes the people he's dealing with, whether they treat their slaves properly, whether they, I don't know, treat their animals properly as well. So there's a choice involved. Right, and then we move on a few thousand years again, let's say, and debts were starting to be recorded on tablets of stone or on slate. So you've heard the expression wiping the slate clean. Well, in Mesopotamia, that was actually part of the law, that if after a period of time you hadn't been able to repay your debts because your crops had failed, for instance, your slate was washed. That's what it said in the law. It said you will wash the slate with water, so your slate was wiped clean. Eventually, those slates, or those tablets of stone in which the debts were recorded, actually began to be transferred themselves among people. And then a group of people thought, well, I know, let's use some representation, something that has a recognized value and a constant value, and we can use that to represent the debts that are owed. Okay, and so we started to use commodities. We started to use gold, silver, or shekels, or which is a fixed weight of wheat. So that was commodity money. It served the function of money that most people will know, things like it had to be a medium of exchange, a unit of account, a store of value. That's what people say money does. Okay, then goldsmiths, silversmiths, and banks got involved. And what they did was they said, well, look, we've got this whole stash of gold that we're looking after for you. So we'll give you something that says, we're looking after the gold for you, and this is how much we're looking after. And then people sort of thought, well, actually, it's an awful lot easier. Rather than going to the goldsmith, getting the gold out, giving it to somebody, they give it back, take it back to the goldsmith again, why not just give them the piece of paper? So that's representative money. And that looks very like the banknotes that we use today, which say, I promise to pay the bearer on demand the sum of £10. And then, somewhere in the, I'm not sure when it was actually, 30s maybe, the governments of the world decided that actually what we would do is move to something called fiat money. So up until then, all money that was in circulation was actually backed up by genuine gold, silver, whatever, bullion. And then they said, well, actually, do you know what? It's an awful lot easier not to bother with all that stuff. Let's just use paper. And of course, now it's digital, so there's even more. So that's kind of money. Started with debt, moved on to being tablets, moved on to being bits of paper, which then just got passed around and then became represented by a series of ones and zeros in a computer. So how do banks fit into the system? Well, banking actually should be really simple. So how it should work is that you've got a bunch of people, they've got some money, and they want somebody to look after it. So they put it in a bank. Okay, and then the bank actually sort of says, well, while we've got all this money, let's do something useful with it. And let's find some people with the ideas and the products that can make this world a better place, or make the economy grow, or feed people, or build factories, make new machines, economic progress, whatever you want to call it. Let's find those good ideas and let's lend the money to them while these people who've deposited with us don't need it. So the money goes in from the depositors, and then the money goes on to the people who are borrowing from the banks. And then the people who've borrowed from the banks pay some interest back to the bank, and the bank takes away some costs on the way and then pays some interest to the people who've lent them some money. So it all makes, you know, perfect sense. It's very, very simple, and it, in that picture, is quite transparent. But what's actually happened is that banks have said, well, really, we don't really see any particular need for you to know where all our money's going. Sorry, all your money's going. Silly me, I'm a banker, I forgot whose money it was. So they forget, they don't bother telling you anymore. And what's more, it's gradually become even more complicated so that people don't really even understand the financial products that the banks are selling them. So not only do they not see what's on the other side of the bank, they don't really understand, because it's become so complex, they don't really understand what actually happens in the bank. Now, we sponsored a survey a little while ago, a couple of years ago, I think it was, which was run for us by Opinium. And they discovered, kind of mind-blowingly, that 30% of people believe that their money just sits in the bank. So you take your cash along, it just sits there. Not sure where they think the interest is then coming from, but hey. And 60% don't know where their money, don't realize that the bank then lends their money and lends it to just whoever the bank likes. Okay, so most people don't actually understand how the financial system works. And that's not a big surprise, because actually most people in the financial system don't really want people to know how the financial system works. Now, the problem with that is that money is power. It has the power to change the world, okay? And it is changing it. So, and we know how important it is, because we see it every day in the headlines. We've seen it for, well, particularly since, what was it, 2008. debt, profit, GDP, rich lists. You know, the Sunday Times publishes a list of the richest people in the UK, in the world, or whatever. So people really, they measure everything by money. Headlines are about money, or about all the things that the financial services industry is doing wrong with our money. So it's clearly very important. It clearly has a lot of power. And what money can do, what that lending can do, is it can fuel positive change, or it can fuel negative change. So the question that we should all be asking ourselves, really, is my money funding things that I think are a good thing to be funded? Is my money funding intensive farming, or being lent to a dictatorship, funding a clothing factory that's making all its clothes in a sweatshop? Is it funding the arms trade, fossil fuel extraction, deforestation? I don't even know. Or is it funding social enterprises, fair trade, renewable energy, organic farming, affordable housing, faith groups? We don't know. So a really quick sort of recap of the story so far. Debt is a social connection. It's a connection between two people, essentially. Money has made it easier to forget that. The financial system has made it even easier to forget that. But it's our money that's in the system. And we used to decide who that money got lent to, but the banks have taken over that role. So the question really is, which bank have you employed to make those decisions on your behalf? How do you know that they're applying your values in making those decisions? And the question that troubles me, but is kind of the root of what Triodos is all about, is how do we get back to making that social connection, getting back to the social connection that it all started with? So, here's how it could be different.
Imagine two banks. Both employ helpful people who deal with your questions, and both are financially sound. At each bank, you can save regularly, earn interest, and of course, manage your account online. Only one bank does it differently. This bank only invests in things which are good for both people and the planet. Things like renewable energy, organic farming, and ecological development. This bank invests in businesses that want to make a healthy profit and want to make a positive difference to society. This bank finances those businesses only with money from their depositors and investors. So the money those people save is invested back into the society they live in. It's actually very simple. Both savers and investors help to build a better, more sustainable world. That one bank is us.
Don't know what happened there. Sorry about that. It's supposed to finish with follow your head, follow your heart, which is our sort of slogan. So 2 points about Triodos. One is that we make those decisions. So we have decided that we think that depositors' money should be invested in things that are positive for the planet, for people. But also, we are completely transparent about where the money goes. So if you go to the website knowwhereyourmoneygoes.co.uk, you will see a complete list of everyone that we lend to and everyone that we invest to worldwide. So we think that banks should be completely transparent about where the money goes. And that means that our depositors can come to our annual meeting, September the 13th in Bristol, in case you're wondering, and they can ask us questions. They can say, why have you invested in that? Why have you lent to them? We don't like those. And we'll answer those questions. Totally transparent. We also publish a lot in our annual report about pay scales, the ratio of the highest paid to the lowest paid employee, about 9 times, since you're wondering, and which is rather a lot less than some of the other banks. And we publish details of all of the sort of social inclusion around the group and so on. So it's a very, very transparent banking model. And we're open to challenge as well. So if people think we're not being transparent enough, they can tell us. So how should the system work? It should be about the people. How are they being treated? They should be treated well. They should be informed. So this is the people in the financial system, okay? Including us, because we're part of it. The banking model should be transparent, not operating in a way which breaks the financial system. Doing the right thing because it's the right thing to do, not because I'm being paid more to do it. And the lending portfolio. Well, we would say lending to the right things, but at a very minimum, transparent about who it's actually being lent to, so that these people have a choice. So we call this sustainable banking, and it's about a conscious approach to using money. So not just chuck it into the system and say, please can I have as much interest back as possible, but I want to know where it's going. Considering its environmental, cultural, and social impact, meeting present day needs, but not at the expense of future generations. And what that transparency does is it restores the social connection. So we have depositing customers who go and meet us, the borrowing customers. Examples. Right, Jamie's Farm, fantastic care farm just outside Bath. And we've taken customer visits there, and people can really see the power of their own money. And it restores that social relationship that used to be there. And I guess the question is... Oops. Sorry. Hang on. I wasn't expecting that one. We're not alone. So... You might think it's just Triodos, but it's not. There's about 25 banks around the world who have formed this thing called the Global Alliance for Banking on Values. They are, if you can see them, they're marked by little sort of blobs on the map on the screen. 25 banks, 10 million customers in 25 countries. They are the Global Alliance for Banking on Values, and they all follow the same kind of precepts as Triodos does. Question, does it deliver anything more than just a kind of a feel-good factor for us and our 35,000 customers in the UK or 500,000 customers across Europe? Well, yes, actually, because you can see the impact, and that's another thing that we're very transparent about. You can see that the deposits and the investments that people have made through the bank have helped 14,720 individuals to use elderly care facilities in 215 care homes, etc., etc. You can see it there. It's all in the annual report. It's all online. And in fact, on the online report, you can make your own little graphs and you can see, you know, you can look, focus on which part of the activities you really care about, whether it's social and faith groups or whether it's the environment. You can see what your money is doing and how it's helping. And I guess the other thing I'd like to point out is how different that is from the other banks, but that it doesn't mean that it's not profitable. Sustainable banks, so the GABV, sustainable banks like Triodos, lend on average about 76% of their balance sheets to businesses and organisations. So they're actually lending 76%. The rest is held back for something called liquidity, which is what we hold to be able to meet the needs of depositors when they want their money. If somebody wants a lecture on the sort of details of how bank balance sheet works, I'm quite happy to do that, but that's probably not the topic for today. Suffice to say, most of what people put in the bank gets lent back out again, and we keep just enough to make sure that we've got the funds they need when they want to withdraw it. Okay? The big banks, what they call the G-SIFIs, globally significant financial institutions, on average lend only about 40%. So they've got to hold about 25%-ish as liquidity. They're lending 4%. What's 40%, sorry. What's happening to the rest? Well, the answer is they're sticking that all into the speculative economy, what economists call FIRE, which is quite a nice acronym, finance, insurance, and real estate. It's the bits that just kind of go round in a big circle and pump up the value of assets until somebody kind of realises that it's all a house of cards. In about 2008, in fact. So they're putting a lot of their deposits into that FIRE economy, okay? But look what it does to the volatility of their return. So the standard deviation line on here, sorry about the technical language, statistical stuff, basically it means how much does it fluctuate over time and between institutions, okay? So on the bottom line, you've got the standard deviation. So right over on the right-hand side, between 2003 and 2012, their profits fluctuated by about 10%. Sustainable banks' profits only fluctuated by less than 3%. Sustainable banks delivered on average about 8% return, and the G-SIFIs not a lot more, 11%. But where you're taking more risk, you would expect to have a better return, and there's not much better return for something that is kind of three or four times the risk. Between 2008, when the crisis hit, and 2012, you've got a different picture again. G-SIFI is still showing 10% volatility. Sustainable banks still showing 2%-ish volatility. Return on equity for the sustainable banks, 7.5%. Return on equity for the G-SIFIs dropped down to 5%. And that's that volatility thing again. Okay? So it isn't just about feeling good. It actually makes a lot of sense. And in fact, Money Facts on their online website, their online survey, they published quite recently that ethical investment funds increased in value by 36% over the last 3 years, compared with 31% for non-ethical funds. Some of that, I admit, is probably because people have become more interested in them, and therefore there's been more money flowing into those funds, so there's a bit of a supply and demand thing. But I think it does illustrate that actually you don't have to be, or you don't have to sort of sacrifice a huge amount of return to be doing something worthwhile with your money. So what else stops people? Well, there's this thing, I'm not really rich enough to make a difference. Let me just put that to rest, okay? So the average UK salary is £26,500. That's about 60 times what a third of the world's population is living on, less than $2 a day. Flip it the other way around. So 60 times the average UK salary is about 1.6 million salary. Okay, so you might think, we might think, we'll leave it to the rich people, we'll leave it to the 1.6 millionaires. The reality is that for at least a third of the world's population, we are the rich people. Okay? So I would say that's probably not a brilliant reason for not doing it. Has anyone heard of Sydney Smith? Usually two or three, and it's about two or three. I love this guy. He's 200 years ago he lived. And he was a reverend. He was a dignitary of Bristol Cathedral at one point. He lectured on moral philosophy at the Royal Institution. But he's got some wonderful pithy quotes, one of which proves that he actually was very far-sighted. He said, "We have yet to see the full impact of the open global marketplace. In 200 years, so that's now, all raw materials and technology will be available everywhere in the world. The only differences between countries and markets will be skill levels, education, and the level of empowerment of the workplace." So this was a guy, 200 years ago, real foresight. There's something else which we have occasionally slipped into wedding cards for friends of ours, which is a brilliant quote. It shows he also understands human beings and human relationships. "Marriage resembles a pair of shears, so joined that they cannot be separated, often moving in opposite directions, but always punishing anything that comes between them." So I just use those just as an illustration. He's far-sighted, he's very wise. And he also said, "It is the greatest of all mistakes to do nothing because you can only do little." Sorry, you can do little. Do what you can. So with that in mind, I would just point out that it doesn't take very much.
We live in a wonderful time. That's something you don't often hear on the news or read in the paper. That's why I'm going to say it one more time. We live in a wonderful time. The freedom we enjoy, the knowledge we've gained, the things we can do, how we're all connected to each other. Every one of us can have our say and be heard. world has grown smaller. Yet when it comes to the economy, we're waiting for something big. A decision from the top. Intervention. A green light. But it doesn't come. The power is no longer in the hands of the big. The strength is in the hands of the small. Although you may not realize it, what you do every day does make a difference. You decide what you do with your money or what you don't. Every act, however small, sets something big in motion. Because small acts create big change. A change to a different economy. One that's fairer, more humane, greener, more innovative. Take a good look around you because it's already here. And here, and here. Now it's up to you. The power is in your hands. Because together we will make small the new big. Follow your heart. Use your head. Triodos Bank.
So you decide. It's your money. You buy fair trade. You buy organic, maybe. When we first helped Café Direct with their share issue, I can't remember, 20 years ago perhaps, fair trade products were just a niche product in brown paper bags. And now almost every supermarket, even the ones we love to hate, have their own brand fair trade product lines. And there's a whole range of organic produce. And that's all because of consumer demand. It came from transparency about what it actually takes to produce the other goods. It came from transparency about the way that people were treated in order to produce some of our coffee. It came from transparency about how pesticides are affecting the world and how the residues are staying in the food that we eat if it's not organic. It came from transparency. Look at the outcry when clothes companies are found to employ child labour. It really hits the headlines, and people really care about it now. So if you take an interest in how the products you buy are sourced and produced, what about all the companies you don't like? And who's keeping them in business? Who's lending them the money to build their factories? Ask your bank how they're using your savings. Try asking TSB, actually, because they've said, we'll be transparent. And all they're saying is, well, we'll lend to the UK. Sounds a bit like, I don't know. Is that the British National Party, actually? I don't know. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, let's keep it in the UK, but we're not going to tell you who within the UK, just so long as we're not lending it overseas. And yes, supporting communities is important, but that's not necessarily the whole story. Show them the issue is important to you and that they need to be accountable to you. If you care about social enterprise or social inclusion or fair trade or organic farming, then you should care about whether they're getting the funding that they need to be able to grow. And don't wait for change from the top, because it's not going to come. Transparency is choice, and it's up to you whether you decide whether to be ethical. So as Voltaire might have said, I do not, or I may not agree with how you invest, but I'll defend to the death your right to have the information to choose. So you could move to a transparent bank, or you could just campaign for transparency on lending, on fees, on pay structures, any other aspect of banking. But the really important thing is that if we don't get that transparency back, if people don't get that connection back, then we won't restore that connection that money gives us with the end user. It destroys the social connectivity of money. Thank you. And any questions? There are some roving mics around, and I've left them to choose who gets to answer the questions. Or, sorry, to ask the questions. I get to answer them. But
last time I checked, probably about a year ago when you were last here, the only accounts you actually do are as savings accounts, is that true? And are there any plans to do anything like a current account?
There are indeed. We Currently, you're right, we have saving, we have instant access savings right through to 5-year savings products, and we have investment funds and so on. But we don't have a current account at the moment. We plan to introduce one. We're hoping to have it in 2016. And the reason that we haven't at the moment is that actually we've not been able to make the business case for it. Another piece of the non-transparency of the banking system is that the way that overdrafts and current accounts work at the moment is that it's called free banking, but it's not really free banking at all, because it costs an awful lot to run all those computer systems and to process checks and all of that, and to have cash machines dotted around and so on. If you are lucky enough to be getting free banking, that probably means that you are rich enough to stay in credit and well organized enough to stay in credit. And your free banking is actually being paid for by the people who aren't rich enough to stay in credit or are too disorganized to stay in credit and are therefore paying fat overdraft fees or penalties or whatever. So gradually that system seems to be changing, but it makes it really hard for a small bank to break into the system, especially if we want to be transparent.
Hello.
Where are you? Sorry. Oh, right, back.
Yes. Can I ask this question?
Yeah.
We'd probably all be very impressed by what you've said. There is a bottom line question. How safe is a bank like this? Because I think many of us leave our money perhaps in other banks because we think they're safer. They've got more reserves perhaps than you have. And we've seen banks that have gone down in recent years. How do you make sure that this style of banking is safe?
Okay. First thing is we have to comply by all the same regulations and rules as all of the other banks do. Then we also actually operate a very, very conservative business model. So in terms of our lending, not only do the borrowers have to pass our sort of normal credit checks, but they are evaluated on the basis of their intent, really. What is it they're trying to do with the money? So that gives us, there's an extra dialogue that's happening there, which means we know our borrowing customers probably a lot better than some other banks. But if it boils down to the financials, most of the big UK banks were struggling to meet the 3% target that the government set a year or so ago for what's called a leverage ratio, or leverage ratio in American. Ours is about 9%, so we've got three times the strength of balance sheet there. Our capital ratios are currently about 18% compared with a minimum of about 8% and about 13% for people like Barclays and Lloyds. So that's the amount of capital that's supporting the bank. Our liquidity, so there's a thing called a liquidity coverage ratio, which is a measure of how much cash has the bank got available to meet its immediate needs. The Basel Committee has set a minimum of 100% for that. Most banks are sort of a little bit above that. We are currently at about 1,050%. which, to be honest, is a problem the other way, because that means we've got to work out what to do with all the money. But we have a very high liquidity ratio. We operate very, very in a very conservative manner, and you can see that from the financials. The other thing is depositor protection. So all UK banks are members of the Financial Services Compensation Scheme, which covers deposits up to £85,000. Now, we're not actually a member of the UK scheme. We're covered by the Dutch scheme because we're a Dutch bank. But the Dutch scheme is basically exactly the same, because it's set up under the directive under which the UK scheme was set up. So, but actually it was in place about 18 months before the banks in the UK got around to doing it. So we have the same kind of level of protection. It's actually 100,000 euros instead of 85,000 pounds. So it does depend on the exchange rate, but basically as long as you've got less than 80,000 pounds with Triodos, you've got the same cover.
Yeah. Oh, hello.
Who's got it? Sorry, I don't know where the mic's gone. Brilliant.
Hello. You touched on it in the answer there, but I was just wondering if you could say a bit about how you choose who you lend to. Is that the same system as with more mainstream banks, or is that a totally different system?
Right. On the credit side, so as I say, there are two choices to make. One is it safe? The other is it sustainable? Okay, so on the safe one, we don't use sort of sophisticated models. for evaluating it is all done on a personal, you know, account by account sort of assessment of the credit worthiness, cash flows, security, and so on of the loan. So that is basically the same as any other bank of our size would do. But then we make a separate assessment about what they're going to be doing with the money, and does that fit with our assessment of what we think money should be used for? So is it going to do positive social, environmental or cultural good? Okay, and also it's about the intent behind it. So what about the individuals? So we make a bit of a judgment call about the individuals themselves as well, who are running the business.
Hello. Do you have any view on the role of credit unions in the whole environment of ethical banking?
Yeah, I'd say they're kind of partners with similar views. I don't think they have quite the same transparency, but they do have a lot of that same social connection. But by being much more local generally, or being specific to a particular group of people, it restores some of that social connection. So I think there are lots of similarities, and in fact, you know, we talk quite closely to a number of credit unions. So I think it's a similar kind of approach, maybe without the transparency, maybe without the same kind of focus on making the world a better place in terms of where the money goes. But it's there with the social connection. He's got the mic. Right.
Given the co-op experience, could you talk to us a little bit about how that happened and how you avoid a similar thing occurring?
My understanding of the co-op experience is that it was largely a problem of governance. It was having people promoted to roles that they weren't suited to, and maybe just not being sufficiently professional. And maybe an element of, hubris. I think there was a period in probably the late 90s and early 2000s when they thought, we're a mid-sized bank. The only way we can compete with the big banks is to become as big as they are. The only way we can come as big as they are is by taking somebody over as big as, say, the Britannia. And that was probably what was behind that ambition. But then ultimately, I think it was about the fact that running a bank is not a simple thing. It's a fairly, you know, it's a very simple sort of business model, but actually there are lots of moving parts and there are lots of regulations and there are lots of risks. The bank is being paid to manage those risks, and you have to have people in place who know how to manage those risks. And if you don't have the right people at the very top, then you don't get the right people in place to manage those risks. So I think it was a problem of governance. And what we do is we have what's called a supervisory board, which is effectively our non-executive directors, and they are drawn from a mixture of backgrounds, but almost all of them have some sort of financial understanding, and we have some very experienced people running the bank. So, and we keep our governance up to date. So, in fact, we're going through a big review at the moment.
Just ask something about debt and bad debts and the collection of bad debts. I was reading something recently about debt collection agencies. This was in the States. I don't know if the same thing applies here. But it would be organisations who had more or less given up trying to get back the money they'd lent to someone and had then sold those debts on to an agency. No matter how lovely the people were who lent the money in the first place, once it was in the hands of the debt collection agency, they'd got no control over the ethics of the people collecting the debts. I wondered if you could just say something about what you do about bad debts or about that generally.
Okay. We don't do any personal lending at the moment. And in fact, it's another point around the current account, we're having a bit of a debate about, you know, should we in fact have overdrafts in a current account? People expect it, but that means you're lending. So at the moment, we don't do any personal lending, and that tends to be the sort of people who are where agencies are being used. But when we have to collect a bad debt, we do it ourselves. And generally, what we find is that that leads to the best outcome anyway, because you're working with the customer to resolve a problem. It's not just, look, you owe me some money, give it to me, whatever. There's usually an underlying problem that has led to them being in trouble in the first place, and it's trying to resolve that with them. So we try and do that, and quite often it works out better that way, for the bank and for them.
Thank you. You've made a strong case for small is beautiful, but some of us like to think big, I think. One of the things that I'm concerned about is just a very basic thing in the banking sector of splitting retail and casino banks. And I wonder whether you've got a campaigning arm, as it were, in Triodos, whether you have some way of influencing that debate, or at least an organisation that's external to you that you think is positive in that sense, because I think that's one of the big changes we need.
Right. We engage with all of those political debates quite directly and at quite a senior level. The nice thing about being a small bank is that you get a seat, you know, alongside the big banks, and they don't get any more representatives on that table just because they're bigger. So you kind of get a much bigger voice because you're just, you know, you're still just one person. So we're engaged in all of those debates. We actually think that splitting the banks is a good thing. We would be a ring-fenced bank. We don't borrow from the wholesale markets at all. We only put liquidity with the wholesale markets, and we don't do any of that kind of, you know, investing in the what I call the fire economy. So we don't do it. We're even having a debate about whether to use swaps. That's how averse we are to derivatives generally. So interest rate swaps, which are just the simplest kind of derivative, and risk management, you know, we don't even do them at the moment. So we quite like the idea of those banks being split apart, or the banks being split between the sort of casino banks, for want of a better description, and the sort of the simple ring fenced banks. We've been talking to government ministers about it. I'm on the what's called the small banks panel of the BBA, the British Banking Association. And again, actually, it's an interesting dilemma because the Ethical Consumer website, which we ranked in the top 10 ethical businesses in the UK over the last, whatever it is, 10 years or something. But we're actually marked down in the Ethical Consumer website in terms of our ethical scoring because we're a member of the BBA, the British Bankers Association. Because the British Bankers Association is deemed to be a lobby group on behalf of bankers, and bankers are by necessity evil. Sorry. Bankers are clearly not the good guys. So we think it's actually quite useful to be a member of the BBA because we get to sit around a table with people like Barclays and Lloyds and so on, and we get to talk to Anthony Brown, who's the chairman of the BBA, and we get invited to seminars, and actually we get to see some of the press releases on behalf of the other banks, which means we can then... on behalf of the BBA, which means we can be ready with a story so that we know what the angle is going to be, and we can kind of be ready with an alternative, and we can put that alternative at the table. So, yeah, we engage as much as we possibly can.
Good morning.
Hi.
I'd just like to come back to one of the points you made a little bit earlier. You said that big banks only earn 40%. The rest is put into finance, insurance and real estate. Well, to my mind, real estate is like all of our mortgages, which is a heck of a lot. So do you therefore not lend out on mortgages and things like that?
We don't lend mortgages at the moment, but we probably will start doing it, but probably on the same sort of basis as the ecology or as we do in the Netherlands. So we lend in the Netherlands on mortgages, and we lend. But what I mean by real estate is more about the sort of the commoditization of real estate. So it's more about sort of buying it when you think it's going up, and then dropping it when it's going down. So it's not so much about what I would call the useful bit. So the distinction isn't quite as black and white as maybe I painted. There's a very detailed academic study that has been done into finance, insurance, and real estate, which estimates that about 7% of finance, insurance, and real estate investment is actually useful, and the other 93% isn't. And by useful, I mean derivatives are a genuinely useful means of managing risk, and some aspects of real estate investment are genuinely useful from an economic point of view. So we would aim to be within the 7% of useful stuff and not in the 93% of speculative activity. Does that answer the question? Ish. No, exactly, and that's my point. But it's only 7% of what goes through the through that fire sector is useful risk management, like insurance, like derivative, genuine derivatives, as opposed to derivatives speculation, if you like, and also, you know, some investment in real estate.
Hello, there's a campaign called Positive Money that also has a store in G-Source, and they're campaigning for monetary reform. And one of the things they're asking for is that. The investment accounts are sectorized, so you put your money in a renewable energy investment account or a small businesses investment account. So the investment priorities of the bank have to reflect the investment priorities of its customers, as well as various other things. I wondered what you thought of that idea. Have you heard of Positive Money?
I've heard of Positive Money and Move Your Money and lots of other campaigns that are trying to get people to really think about where their money goes. And I think, and in a way, you know, what my message is that is the important thing is not so much, you know, I'm not worried so much about what decision people make about what to do with their money, so long as they're actually thinking about it in the first place and not just kind of saying that's it's a sort of a something different. So it's definitely a step towards transparency, and we've had similar things. So we had, I can't remember, I think it's called an Earth account or something like that. We've had specific accounts at different times which have been... Where the money has been specifically set aside to be invested in, or it's, you know, we make sure that we're investing at least that amount of money in that sector, so that people can know that if they've put 100 quid in into the Earth account or whatever it was called, I can't remember what it, Earth Saver, I think it was, they know that that's going towards funding environmental protection or that sort of thing. We also now, though, we're doing a lot more with partnerships, and in fact, Greenbelt is one of our affinity partners, and if you open an account with Triodos and you say that you heard about it through Greenbelt, then Greenbelt gets 40 quid. So there you go. It's a really good reason to open an account. Who's got the mic?
I won't stand up because I'll fall splat on the floor off my little chair.
Oh, there you are, right.
Two hopefully very quick questions. Firstly, how much of the volatility in profits of the major banks you were talking about is to do with PPI provision and stuff like that, impacting profits? And secondly, if you're talking about a bank with 35,000 customers, I can see how you can list what you're investing in. But if you're talking about a retail bank with a million and odd current account holders, however many unsecured loans, mortgages, that kind of range, how on earth do you hope to maintain that sort of degree of transparency? I mean, I know you can look at a bank's annual report and see things like the bad rates to get an idea of how much risk your bank's taking, capital ratios, liquidity. But how do you sort of make that accessible in a way that actually means something to people? Did you see what I'm trying to get at?
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. And it's again, it's a debate that we are probably going to have, you know, because it seems unlikely that we'll publish the name of every single person who's borrowing a mortgage or who has an overdraft with us or whatever. That doesn't seem very feasible. So our loan documentation stipulates that that everybody who's... who's borrowing from us, that we can publicise their name. We obviously don't give the commercial details of the loan, we just say they are borrowing. Okay, we've been doing that for, the bank's been running for about 30 years now, so I would have thought that any commercial bank that had the same idea at the same time would have had pretty much their whole loan portfolio covered by now. I don't see a problem on a commercial, you know, on the sort of the commercial lending side. More personal lending on sort of mortgages and current accounts, I don't know how we'll tackle that, actually, and I don't know how they tackle it in the Netherlands. So perhaps I'll go onto the website when we've finished and have a quick look. Maybe it's by sector, maybe it's by region, maybe it's by town, I don't know. But I think what would be important would be to be really clear that this is how much we're lending in mortgages and this is how much we're lending in personal overdrafts, so that without making a judgment about an individual that people know nothing about, they can at least make a judgment about whether they like that level of personal debt on a bank's balance sheet. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
How are we doing? 10 minutes. Yeah.
After the cooperative experience,
and what happens there. I'm suspicious of banks setting themselves up as ethical. And where do Triodos stand on the position of senior managers and those at the top of the tree earning high salaries and huge bonuses? And how customer-friendly is Triodos in how many branches they may have open?
Okay. We have no high street branches. We do everything by phone or by internet. Although you know, the loan managers visit personally for the lending, but from the personal banking side, it's all by phone or by internet. But we have real people on the end of the phone. In fact, two of them are in G-Source at the moment, and you could go and see whether you think they're friendly or not. But I can assure you that Joe and I can't remember the other ones there, but anyway, they're very friendly. In terms of senior management, we don't pay bonuses. We don't pay any contractual bonuses. No bonus is allowed to be more than, I think it's no more than 2 months' salary, but actually it's tiny. You know, there's basically no bonuses. We have one universal pay, each year there's a discretionary bonus which is awarded or decided upon by the senior management of the bank in the Netherlands, and everybody, chief executive down to whatever you want to think of as the lowest of the low, salary gets the same, and it's last year it was €300. And as I said before, the chief executive's total pay is about, I think it's about nine times the lowest paid person, and it's published obviously in the accounts. So where's the mic there?
Am I right in understanding that that the bank subscribes to Rudolf Steiner principles? Mm. And if so, what direct impact does that have on the bank and its running?
I think it's true to say that the bank was founded by, I think it was four economists in Holland who were very strongly influenced by anthroposophy and therefore by Steiner principles. There is very little direct influence, though, in the bank now. It is basically, it's about the values that we have. The only thing that you would probably give you a clue is the fact that every Monday morning, we have a co-worker meeting every Monday morning, and every branch has that co-worker meeting, so every country in which we operate, and it's always on a Monday morning, and at the end of it, we finish with what is variously called the verse or the phrase or the saying or something, and when it's a quote from Steiner, which in a slightly ropey English translation says, "The healthy social life is found when in the mirror of each human soul the whole community finds its reflection, and when in the community the strength of each one is living." So just one person just reads it out, and it's just a little reminder of the fact that the bank is a community and it's part of a community. That's probably the strongest influence that Steiner now has on the bank. Plus, we have a few Steiner schools as customers. Yeah.
So you have good banking and bad banking. So can you help us? Is it better to stay in the bad bank and challenge and get them to improve, or is it better to disconnect from that bad bank and join a good bank?
Good question. Really good question. Could you do both? Have you got enough money to do both? I think that's your choice. Which is better? I think what you could do is campaign for against the big banks or try to persuade the big banks. But it's a debate that we constantly have. So we have a number of SRI funds, socially responsible investment funds. And again, we're transparent about where those investments hold funds. And so, for instance, until recently, we held shares in Google. And we published all the reasons why, despite the fact that the tax was being, they were being hauled over the coals for their tax avoidance, so-called. But actually, the point was they weren't breaking the law. But by being investors, we could engage directly with them and make the point that we didn't think that this was the right way to behave. If you're not an investor, it's much harder to engage. I'm not sure if we still do, but I think at one point we had one share in Tesco's. Because that gave us the right to go and stand up at their annual meeting and make a noise. So we do have a policy of engagement, and I think that if you feel that that's the best way to make a difference, then go to another bank and engage with that bank. Or you can put your money somewhere where the bank engages on your behalf. It's a difficult choice.
Hi, I am working biology. Oh, sorry.
Hang on a second. Sorry, I just want to make sure that's okay with the questioner. Yeah, great. Right, sorry.
Sorry, I'm over here.
Okay, hi.
Hi, I work in biology research, and it was interesting to hear you mentioning organic farming, which is a nuanced and complex debate as to the advantages, if there are any, compared to many other systems of farming. How, more broadly, do you choose which campaigns, which things are ethical? And do you take what kind of evidence bases do you use to make that decision?
We engage with a lot of NGOs and a lot of scientific studies. In fact, we've just published the Trios Foundation actually just published a piece of scientific research into I think it was hundreds of pieces of literature on organic research to try and pull it together, to try and get exactly that kind of answer, because it's important to us that we do the right thing. And actually on that, the answer was generally it's pretty clear that organic food is better for you than non-organic food because it's got fewer trace elements, because it allows the body to work better. But also, interestingly, there are all sorts of other aspects. So organic farming generally has less water runoff because organic matter in the soil holds, I can't remember what the percentage is, but much more than farmland, which has been farmed more intensively, and therefore the soil has got more sandy, and so you get more flooding down in the valleys if you've got intensive farming on the hills. So all sorts of other reasons. But we're always open to persuasion, and it's a very open debate. And again, if you go onto the Triodos Investment website, you will see the results of some of those that research. So you'll see that particular piece of research there. You will see explanations, for instance, of to why we still include H&M. Is it H&M? The clothing people? Yeah. H&M in our socially responsible investment list, because they're continually hitting the headlines, or they had been continually hitting the headlines for having child labour or slave labour. And so they put in a very clear explanation, and they said, well, the reason we continue to invest in H&M is that, unlike some others, whenever we go to them and challenge them on this, they do something about it. They actually do care. But the reality is it's really hard to keep track of a global supply chain. But whenever we point out to them that they're doing something wrong, they fix it. And that's okay. So likewise, I mean, we had investments in Toyota. Then Toyota started operating in Myanmar. So we said, okay, that's a repressive regime. We don't want anything to do with you anymore. They pulled out of Myanmar, and then we're back in again. But then you get into another debate. Well, is it better? It's like the engagement debate. Is it better to actually engage with a company that's trying to make, you know, that is planning employment in Myanmar and so on? Or is it better to just pull out and say, no, we don't like it? Our lives are full of dilemmas, I'm afraid.
Kit, I'm really sorry, but we don't really have any more time for questions because we've got to get the venue ready for the next event. But there are loads of people wanting to ask you questions. Will you be available in the G store later?
Yeah, I might grab some lunch, but if that's all right. Otherwise, my blood sugars are going to go down. Okay. But yeah,
I will
be in the G store perhaps in half an hour.
That'd be fantastic. We show our appreciation in the usual way. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for listening.